Bonjour à tout le monde et bienvenue à cette discussion qui va s'engager très bientôt. I'm delighted to see you all here. This is an important day for McGill, and we have three very very distinguished persons who are associated with the university, and we're going to challenge us intellectually in the course of the next hour or so. I'm Yves Fortier, and I'm co-chair of Campaign McGill, and I'm thrilled at having been asked to be the moderator of this conversation between three of McGill's most respected and most distinguished researchers. We're here to learn. I have no doubt that we will learn a lot. We'll be discussing a number of issues which face the world today. un monde dans lequel les frontières s'amenuisent de plus en plus. On devient interdépendants les uns des autres. If you talk about war, peace, protection of human rights, of basic human rights today, whose job is it to fashion all of these challenges which face the world? So we have a good 90 minutes. It's a daunting array of subjects, one of the things that we'll try to do is to demonstrate how McGill, in this context, is making a difference. It's a trite expression, making a difference in the world. But I think you will live with our three participants how it is possible in a myriad of ways to make a difference in the world today. You're never too small or too isolated, to interface with others and to mettre l'épaule à la roue and contribute to the debate, which of course ends up in a search for solutions, and these solutions are the the work of non-governmental organizations, people like our three speakers, and associations like the United Nations, which I know something about, which I'm sure will feature into the conversation. So let me give you some brief introductions, very brief. I was told by our three modest colleagues that the briefer the better. I shall proceed to do this. François Crépeau, il n'y aimerait pas ça que je dise qu'il est le fils de Paul, mais c'est très difficile pour moi.
Je vis avec.
C'est très difficile pour moi de ne pas faire référence à François comme étant le fils de Paul, qui était un contemporain, effectivement, à Oxford et ailleurs, et qui est un des grands juriste du Québec, le père du Code civil. François has joined the Faculty of Law, not initially. I guess the shadow of his father kept him away from McGill, but he is here, and hopefully he's here to stay. He's the Hans and Tamar Oppenheimer Professor of Public International Law, a fellow of the Trudeau Foundation, and a member of the Canadian Commission for UNESCO. He's participated in observation missions in the Palestinian territories and El Salvador. So I welcome on your behalf, François. And then Khalid Mustafa Medani is an assistant professor of political science and Islamic studies at McGill. Before coming to the university, he's worked for numerous leading international educational institutions, and the list is daunting. Oberlin College, Stanford University, the Brookings Institution, the UNDP, the Canadian International Development Research Center. He's published widely on the roots of civil conflict and Islamic terrorism. So very, very topical. I look forward to listening to Khalid. And Philip Oxhorn is the founding director of the McGill Institute for the Study of International Development. And his research focuses on civil society and its role in supporting democratic regimes, particularly in Latin America. So it's a good mishmash of expertise that we have here. Philip has lectured in North and South America, Western Europe, Australia, and I welcome Professor O'Horn. The format: my colleagues are going to start with a brief opening statement, about 8 to 10 minutes, and then I'll try and generate an informal discussion between the panelists, and then I want to involve you, all of you. So let's start. Our friends have agreed with the order of presentations, and we start with Professor Medani, please.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad that I didn't have to introduce you. We would be here all night, probably all day. I'm the first speaker, so I have the daunting task of kind of highlighting or kind of framing the discussion a little bit in terms of the objective of this panel, and that is defining peace and looking at alternatives in terms of actually in building peace globally. In terms of the definition, I thought I would base it on my own particular research, which is based on kind of the study of the roots of Islamic militancy and also civil conflict, particularly in the Horn of Africa, in Sudan in particular. And so within that context, for me, a definition of peace would be the absence of economic, social, and security risks. And that, I think, really points to or relates very much to the kind of research that I do that has to do with the factors that have contributed to the recruitment of Islamic militants in Egypt in particular, but also in the Sudan. And the reason I wanted to highlight that is because the literature on this particular topic, which, as you were saying, is very topical, and my own particular research, you know, in cooperation with the Carnegie Corporation in New York, really points to the economic factors associated with the incentives of young men, in particular, joining these Islamic militant organizations. And I want to highlight that the issue of economic insecurity plays a very, very important role in why so many people join these Islamic militant organizations. So that's kind of one avenue of research. Another avenue of research has to do with the roots of civil conflict in Africa, and in particular in Sudan, where I've done the research, whether it's in southern Sudan or in Darfur, which I've also conducted research. And there also, we know that economic incentives drive a lot of people, young men and also women, into insurgent organizations. And so those two kind of elements are very important to keep in mind. And so focusing on the absence of, or the kind of dealing with the economic insecurity issues is extremely important. Now, in realistic terms, I think that one way to tackle that is to frame it in terms of what we call social security systems. And this is a project I'm doing with IDRC, with the Canadians, actually. Not social welfare necessarily, but social protection systems, that is utilizing and helping grassroots organizations in these countries to deal with particular issues. Private volunteer organizations, informal networks and informal organizations. One example, for example, is the role of Islamic welfare organizations in Islamic countries, which play a very, very important role in social welfare. Now, some people have said they promote these kind of militant organizations, but in my research, I found that's not necessarily the case. And so the idea is to, if there is a political will, not only in terms of the Canadians or the Americans, so to speak, but also in kind of domestic governments, to work in partnership with these kind of non-governmental and private voluntary organizations, which I think is extremely important to keep in mind. In terms of the role of Canada in conflict generally, I would kind of point to the responsibility to protect doctrine, which I think is really important. Certainly that has been very important in terms of Canadian intervention in the Sudan and in Darfur. But one of the questions that was posed to us was a very important one. That is, in terms of Canadian involvement in these conflicts, you know, what are the positive aspects of that and what can be the counterproductive aspects of that? Now, that's a very big question, obviously. But in general, I would say that we have to really take into account local realities. That is, Canadian intervention in a place like Darfur or assisting intervention in Darfur should look at the local realities themselves rather than be driven by kind of external actors. And what I mean by that in particular, and this is something that I was inspired to speak about through my students who asked me, you know, what can we do about Darfur? And they asked me that almost on a weekly basis, well, sometimes on a daily basis. And one thing I always say is to listen, first of all, to understand the nature of these conflicts, and also to listen to the people themselves who, in Darfur and other conflict zones, who have a way of really telling you what to do. So in the case of Sudan and Darfur in particular, one thing that Canadians can do, or the Canadian governmental institutions can do, is to really look at the comprehensive nature of the problem, which has to do with the lack of democracy. Okay? One of the failures of the peace talks in Darfur that the Canadians were involved in, and I went to Ottawa several times to speak about that, had to do with not really understanding the nature of the conflict itself. That is, it wasn't just a regional conflict, but a conflict having to do with the entire country and the absence of democracy. So in this particular case, I would kind of, and I know Professor Oxon will speak about this in the case of Latin America, democracy can actually be an avenue of conflict resolution. And I would kind of like to end, I'm not sure if I have any more time, but I'd like to end with highlighting the potential Canadian role in the upcoming democratic elections, or, you know, I don't know how democratic they're going to be, but in a year's time, there are going to be elections in the country of the Sudan that are very much related to the Darfur conflict. And I think in partnership with the United States and the United Nations, which is very active in this process right now, and I see a lot of developments in Ottawa that are very, very positive in terms of promoting the potential of free and fair elections that people in Darfur, when I was there, told me was the most important long-term factor associated with resolving that conflict. So let me end there and kind of welcome questions a little bit later.
Thank you very much, Professor Madani. And now I'll ask Professor Krippel to address us.
Merci. Je voudrais aussi peut-être vous donner mon point de départ. J'enseigne le droit international public, le droit international des droits de l'homme, des droits de la personne, et je m'occupe beaucoup de la recherche en droit international des migrations, des réfugiés et en droit international des minorités. Donc ça, c'est mon point de départ. My point today is that we have to take human rights and the rule of law seriously. And that's, I'm the lawyer here, so I'm not the only one, though. Have the floor. So that'll be my point. And I think it's a condition for lasting peace in any democratic setting. It means several things. First, it means the respect, protection, and promotion of human rights as an essential element of the recognition of the dignity of any human being. And this means all human rights. It includes civil and political rights, which is what Global North countries have been promoting since World War II. But it also means economic, social, and cultural rights. And I think this links into what Khaled has said. Most countries in the Global North, but also elsewhere, and including Canada, utterly reject economic, social, and cultural rights as a meaningful tool. And they say, the argument goes, they are not justiciable, courts should not interfere with budgetary decisions regarding allocation of resources. And this reasoning has been proven wrong. First of all, who said that prohibition of torture and the right to life, liberty, and security of a person are cheap? We just have to look at the Arar case to see that it is very costly to protect against torture and to protect life and freedom. It takes a whole court system, a whole institutional system. Second, courts out there, the Constitutional Court of South Africa, the Supreme Court of India, have shown that one can actually implement economic, social, and cultural rights. The right to health, for example, it's not the right to be healthy. That we know doesn't exist. We're essentially different, all different on that. It is the right to two things. One, a minimum of health service, defined according to the level of development. For us, for example, it would be the right to be triaged in an emergency ward and not be told, oh, we don't have room, just go to the other hospital. We have the right to be triaged if we're bleeding, if there is a condition. So that's the minimum. But it's also the right not to be discriminated against in the way we access the existing healthcare system. And these are things that courts know how to deal with, and which are difficult, even in Global North countries. Let us think in Canada about the treatment of First Nations persons in the Canadian health and education institutions, for example. This will also mean recognizing specific rights in favor of minorities and Aboriginal peoples, including collective rights when where need be, and probably in small doses. And I would say that the protection of all these rights for the most vulnerable persons in society is a benchmark for democracy. And we often miss it. We're not up to that task. We just have to think about women, detainees, Aboriginals, the poor, gays and lesbians, migrants, minorities. For many of all these people who may find themselves in a vulnerable situation, we're not providing adequate respect, protection, and promotion of their rights. It means also taking the rule of law seriously. It can be interpreted in different ways. The way I will define it for today's exercise is the ability of any person or group to find an effective recourse against a violation of one's rights and freedoms by any public or private power that be. Finding a recourse, finding someone who might redress the wrong that's being done. This means building an institutional infrastructure that is able to respond to individual and collective demands for redress. And this is an essential element of the legitimacy foundation that any democratic political power is seeking, a democracy that commands the trust of the individual to the system of government that we have, whatever the popularity of the government of the day may be. Jean Monnet, one of the founders of the European Union, once famously said, "Nothing will be created without men, nothing will last without institutions." That's where he embarked on the creation of the institutions of the European Union. These institutions for the rule of law certainly include a court system, which will be able to make final pronouncements on allegations of human rights violations. And we have developed rules, international rules and domestic rules, regarding how independent and impartial tribunals can provide fair proceedings. We know how to do that. And our states, including in the north, tend to forget that in times of emergency. But these institutions may mean other types of institutions, other conflict resolution mechanisms that can prove satisfactory to the parties and not be as constraining as a full-fledged court system in different situations. There may be permanent mechanisms, such as human rights commissions, ombudspersons, equality commissioners, mechanisms for complaints against the police or the armed forces, guaranteeing the freedom of the media, arbitration panels. All these mechanisms function to try to solve conflict in societies. They will also include other independent institutions necessary to guarantee the trust of the people. The Auditor General, for the accounts of the country, an Electoral Commission, even traditional Aboriginal or local conflict resolution mechanisms. It may also include more ad hoc post-conflict institutions, truth and reconciliation commissions, post-conflict mechanisms for compensation and reparation, tribunals for addressing crimes against humanity and war crimes, mechanisms for the settlement of Aboriginal land claims, etc. These institutions can be international, domestic, mixed, and there's often no one-size-fits-all model for that. Each institution must be developed according to the traditions and sensitivities of the peoples and the countries at stake. And all these institutions must also be accessible for individuals and groups, and especially the most vulnerable of them, to come back to the first point. Now, we know that legal mechanisms, and that's very often something I have for my students, legal mechanisms by themselves cannot guarantee peace, order, and good government, as we used to say. It's only a tool. Law is only a tool in the hands of people who do something with it. And without political mobilization, legal instruments can be devoid of effectiveness. One generally needs a vibrant civil society. We need courageous individuals, resourceful NGOs that will push for reform and transformation in order for these legal mechanisms to be effectively implemented in favor of the individuals and the groups that they're intended to serve and protect. But this institutional framework is the embodiment of a checks and balances system of government, of a conviction that the exercise of power can only be democratic if strong and independent and effective counterpowers are established. It's also based on the belief, and many of our governments tend to forget that, even here in Canada, that the will of the people is not solely in the hands of our elected representatives, that majorities can be wrong. And that's one of the lessons of the human rights movement, and certainly of the history of the 30s in Europe. One can argue that the will of the people is also in the hands of the judges and other institutions who must coherently interpret constitutional and international human rights guarantees, even against the will of the majority of the people or the will of the majority of our elected representatives. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
OK. Alors, merci, François. Now I'll turn to Philip for your piece, Philip.
Thank you. I mean, the problem with going last after two pretty thought-provoking speeches is I just have more and more to say. So I'll try and focus on the key issues that I think will get a discussion going and maybe provoke you to think a little bit. I mean, like my colleagues, I think democracy is the key. And for me, I define it very simply. The democratic government is an accountable government, a responsive government through active citizen participation. So obviously elections are one way of doing that, but they're not the only way. Like Khalid said, democracy is actually a mechanism for conflict resolution. One of my favorite authors from the 70s said that if people agreed on everything, you wouldn't need democracy. It's when they disagree that you need democracy. So that's my starting point. And I think that the main points I'm going to make are going to complement my colleagues in an important way, because if we really believe in democracy, we really want to support democracy, and I think it's very important that internationally we support democracy. I think Canada is a role model in that regard on a variety of levels. We have to behave democratically too, which means we have to talk to people. And I'll just give you two very quick examples that are related. A friend of mine was telling me she works in Africa, actively involved in the donor philanthropic third sector activities, and she was saying she bumped into a scientist, I think he was an American, who said after spending millions of dollars on developing a high-protein food that I can't remember the name, which is indicative of something, they had to close down the project, and he was devastated. And she said, well, why? He says nobody wanted to eat it. I think that's part of the problem. Had the gentleman talked to what people like to eat, then maybe he would have decided to invest in products that are more palatable to what the people are used to. Another very similar example, the FAO did a study, and they consistently find this anyway, and this, when food prices go up and economic times are hard, people stop eating vegetables and sources of what they call micronutrients. And they didn't know why. Well, obviously, the reason is pretty clear. You can't fill yourself up on tomatoes. And there's a comfort food aspect, too. You go back to the staples that not only fill you up, but make you feel better. And I think that both examples really underscore what I think is one of the key reasons why we should support democracy, why democracy is a mechanism for conflict resolution. And it's because priorities have to be set. And like I said, if we all agreed on everything, then we wouldn't have to worry about priorities. And even when we do agree on everything, we may not agree on priorities. And it's through working with civil society, which is what my research focuses on, that priorities are set in a meaningful way. And that's what makes democracy democratic. And so when the international community supports democracy, it has to do so in a way that reinforces this basic process of seeking ways of mediating differences, of setting priorities in a way that will be seen as legitimate. Now, with that in mind, I'll just give you two very similar but yet different examples of the role that the international community needs to play in this regard. And part of this as a subtext comes from a project I'm working with for the International Development Research Center, which involves looking at seven countries in various stages of conflict or post-conflict resolution. And what the studies have consistently shown is that external actors play a pivotal role in ending conflict. But what they also show, and this is very, very worrisome, is that it's very, very difficult to then wean these countries off of dependence on international communities. There are a lot of reasons for that, and usually it's not because people are not well-intentioned, it's that because they haven't gotten it right. They haven't figured out a way of making democracy in this sense sustainable so that conflicts will never reoccur, so that countries don't become dependent, however unwillingly, on an external intervention. Now, then the first example I'm going to give you is actually one from when I was doing my doctoral dissertation in the mid-80s. And the doctoral dissertation was on opposition to the Pinochet military rule in Chile in the shanty towns. And so basically what I was trying to understand is how poor people without any rights that were recognized by the state could vent their frustration, mobilize, and try and bring about a democratic transition. And this is a very rich time in Chile. It's when thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets when it was actually dangerous to do so, particularly in slums where it's much easier to repress than to negotiate because the newspapers aren't in the slums, they're downtown, which is also where middle class people tend to protest. And that's where you don't see the repression, you see it in the slums. And the anecdote I want to share with you is the positive role that the U.S. ambassador at the time played in facilitating the transition. You know, as many of you probably realize, the U.S. was very actively involved in the coup that brought Pinochet to power. And what was happening was that through very good choices of ambassadors, the U.S. was gradually changing its position. And what the ambassador did in 1987, which was very, or 1986, excuse me, which was pivotal, was that he actually sided with the protesters in a very public way. And so if some of you may recall two people in a summer protest in Chile, it was our summer, their winter, were burned alive. And one of them died, and the other one, he actually came to Canada for reconstructive surgery. And what the U.S. ambassador did is he went to the funeral of the young man who died. And a member of the Communist Central Committee at the time said, gee, you know, I wish we would have had him as ambassador back in 73 because the world would have been different. And the point is that the U.S. played a very, very important role that was respected by people who basically didn't respect the U.S. because of what it did in the past. But it was successful because it didn't impose, it didn't create, but it built on and supported what was already happening in Chilean society. It happened to be about democratic transitions, but the bottom line is that the U.S. engaged with Chile in a very, very democratic way. The other example is much more recent. As many of you probably know from the news, again in the summer, I think it was in June or July, Latin America had its first coup d'etat in decades. When the military summarily took the president of Honduras out of his bed, put him on a plane to Costa Rica. Now, what's really important here is that, again, consistent with what Francois said, is that the world, for the first time, unanimously said, this is wrong, that Zedela, the president, had to be returned to power. Even if it was with restrictions on his power, he had to be returned to power. He couldn't have democratic elections as were planned for this November unless he was back in power, because unconstitutional regimes can't have democratic elections. And what I want to highlight with this example is something very, very simple. On the one hand, the international community got it right. They said, this is wrong, we will not accept it, we will not legitimate it, and that's good. The problem, though, is that the declarations without teeth can actually be counterproductive. And the reason is very simple. what happens if the elections go forth in November, as they look like they will go forth, and then as scheduled under the Constitution that was only momentarily suspended, a government is reinstalled that was democratically elected. What will the world community do? Will they ignore that, or will they be forced, out of practical concerns, to deal with that? And the problem this raises is very simple. If Honduras, a small, very, very poor country, can basically stand up to the world and say, we'll do what we want, thank you, then what's going to happen the next time there's a political crisis in a country that has more resources that isn't as poor, or a country like, say, Venezuela, where it not only has resources, but it has the at least the facade, if not the reality, of being a progressive revolutionary regime that the North picks on anyway. And so the point is that when the international community assumes responsibilities, it's very, very important that it sees them through. It may mean difficult decisions, but it means sanctions have to be imposed immediately to give teeth to those declarations. And ultimately, why will that work? It will work because, as happened in Chile, people will say enough is enough. They'll create the kind of core constituency that you need to bring democracy back. Because let's face it, if Hondurans don't demand democracy, the U.S., the OAS, the United Nations can't impose it. So again, it's not only recognizing the responsibility that the international community has to ensure that its edicts are followed, but it, again, it's a plea really to look for allies in civil society that can help back that up. And sanctions sometimes are the only way to do it, because if people don't realize there's a cost to pay, then they may not do anything, and then our declarations, our good intentions will go nowhere. And the last thing that I'll say, just in the minute or so that I have left, is something that I think is more positive. And it really underscores how simple these things can be. About 10 years ago, people began to organize throughout sub-Saharan Africa a campaign where volunteers would ensure the delivery of medication for river blindness. Now, river blindness is a horrific disease. It affects tens of millions of people, and about 150 million people are vulnerable. The problem with it, not surprisingly, is that those who are most vulnerable live in the most remote areas and they're the poorest people. Reaching them is very, very difficult. Now, to do it through traditional Western medicine, you build hospitals, you build roads, you really kind of overcapitalize it, is just not thinkable. The only way to reach these people is if these people do it themselves. And so over the last 10 years, about 600,000 volunteers were mobilized. They were chosen because of their role in the community to ensure that the medication was delivered. The medicines were donated by the firm that developed and owns the patent, Merck. And so it's an ideal example of where working with civil society, the international influence has not only been positive, but it's been sustainable. You know, 600,000 people, that's a huge number of people, and we're talking about the poorest of the poor. And what did these 600,000 volunteers get in return? Food, relief from doing other communal duties. So it's actually low cost. And so Northern technology, Northern medicine, working with, you know, just simple basic ideas really paves the way for all sorts of things that might happen so that societies can choose their own priorities, work with the international community to make those rights and those institutions not only appear on paper, but to make them effective in practice. Thanks.
Thank you, Philip. We have not been disappointed. These have been three very, very thoughtful and very thought-provoking statements. I see a common denominator between the three interventions. And I think that common denominator is democracy. Democracy, as François said, requires or imposes or presupposes the rule of law. Democracy for Philip is the recipe for conflict resolution. And Khalid, I think even when you refer to your experience in Darfur and made the point that economic security will all too often drives militancy, you still see a light at the end of the tunnel with the election coming to Darfur. what is the role of, and I ask a question to the three of you, what is the role of the international organizations like the UN in making sure that in the different silos that you have identified, democracy is going to prosper. I think I'll start with you, Kelly, because you made the point that economic security. We heard that after 9/11 all too often that it happened because there's so much economic insecurity in certain parts of the world. And yet, if you look at the forms of government in the Middle Eastern Arab countries, democracy is unknown. So how do you tie it in and then bring it back to New York and the United Nations?
New York, you mean 9/11 New York?
No, my goodness. No, I was talking about that that building on the East River.
That's right. Well, what I meant about, in terms of 9/11, there is a difference between what we call the potential pool of militants and those who actually do the things that they do in terms of 9/11. Okay, so this is not to discuss, Muhammad Atta or Osama bin Laden. But in the combination of state repression, then this is not a way to be an apologist for this stuff. In fact, I've been working on this for maybe 15 years now on the other side. It's really a question of economic insecurity that then is exploited by particular individuals. And this we know from a lot of studies, not only in terms of Islamic militants and extremism, but also other religions as well, historically. And so the notion of economic insecurity and not poverty is important, and state repression is also, and state authoritarianism is important. Now, in terms of the link, and I'm very obviously happy you asked that question, there is also, it's also well known, and we do know that the moderation of these groups can be managed with political liberalization. Okay, we see successful examples of this, in Jordan, in Yemen, in Morocco. One of my students here is working on that particular issue. And so political liberalization here, and not necessarily democracy, to Professor Oxhorn was, there are so many different forms of democratization. There is no question that the political liberalization, political openness managed in a particular way, and we see it across different cases, is crucial to the moderation of these groups. To the extent that the international community, the United States, let's say, in its relationship with Egypt, is not kind of taking, a close examination of this, obviously it's a problem. And so one can make a very important and rational case for, let's say, U.S. policymakers that their promotion of political liberalization in a case like Egypt would also go hand in hand with one of their primary foreign policy objectives, which of course is counterterrorism and, to reduce Islamic extremism in the region, a region that is so important to them and to the entire world. So that question is really important. Now that has to do with Islamic extremism. Democracy for civil conflicts is not always conducive to resolution. And here, one has to be careful about that. But having said that, the United Nations and its agencies can manage in cooperation and coordination with regional governments. What we do know is that regional actors, let's say Kenya, Uganda, that surround southern Sudan, played a very, very important role in the peace agreement of 2005 that ended Africa's longest running civil war. Canada was also involved, the United States was very involved. So in terms of the role of the UN, and the resolution of civil conflicts, what I would say is that Canada, the United States, and the international community can use the good offices of the United Nations. I have many friends and relatives who work with the UN, and they always say, the good thing about us is that we're actually on the ground. And so you can use us, you can utilize us. And in this instance, this was a wonderful, successful case of the Canadians and the Americans. America played a very, very positive role in sustaining the peace talks
between the rebels and the government and Kenya and Uganda, ensuring that we actually lead to resolution, and it did in 2005. The opposite happened in Darfur. Lack of sustainability because the international community, by the way, what we called, went too quickly and gave up too quickly in terms of the diplomatic peace talks of the Abuja peace talks in Nigeria, and did not engage the neighboring countries in the way they did in southern Sudan. So they can use the good offices of the United Nations as a coordinating facility to sustain peace talks, and those eventually do in fact resolve conflicts. We've seen that across different cases. Hope that helps.
Thank you very much for that reply, which was right on point, which is not always the case when you moderate a panel. I was delighted. I was delighted to hear from you, Philip, that actually ambassadors can make a difference. that was music to my ears. But let me see, François, of the three initial statements, I guess yours was the closest that came to actually identifying an institution, which I interpreted to mean the United Nations. You said that, you quoted Jean Monnet, the man and the work of man eventually needs to an institution that is going to implement, represent what man wants to do. Could you expand a little bit on that? I think it would be of interest to our friends here.
Mm-hmm. I think the one thing the UN can do and is tool to do, although it doesn't have enough resources, is remind people that democracy is not simply an electoral process. Mm. Democracy is a much more complex thing that takes a toolbox that is much more complex than simply creating an election and having parties and electing a president or electing an assembly. It's much more complex than that. One of the things that Philip said that is important, setting priorities, and I want to use that as a point. I think that what I was trying to say, an example of what I was trying to say in terms of protecting human rights and implementing the rule of law, is allowing the individual, and especially the marginalized individual, to oblige the authorities to justify their priorities. Mm. And this can be done. And this can be this can be done, for example, through courts. And I'll just give you an example from the Supreme Court of India about a case that happened in Bengal. It was a man who had been refused dialysis at the hospital. He had a heart condition, and this could be fatal. And he went to court saying, why am I refused this dialysis? And the state of Bengal hospital that was attacked came to court and said, okay, we have this number of dialysis machines. We have established this priority list. And the priority list includes pregnant women and children. And at the bottom of the list are people who have heart conditions because we prefer to give, and this is a choice they made, we prefer to give dialysis to people who are less at risk of dying soon, etc. So you're not a priority. And the Supreme Court of India said, you know what, this was a good justification of your priorities. We may agree or disagree, but you did what was required, which was to have your priorities and to be able to justify them. And I think that's a very important element in terms of democracy. It has a pedagogical effect about rights. The institutions play a role in obliging the government to explain, and the explanation may be good or bad. And this is, to me, this is a very democratic process that empowers the individual, that allows the authorities to assert their decision-making power, but not in any way they wish, in a coherent, rational explanation. And I think that institutions can sustain that kind of process. That might not answer your question.
Well, it's all under the aegis of the rule of law. that does tie it into to what was said earlier. You know, Philip, I couldn't help thinking when you were referring to the situation in Chile in the 80s, and then the situation which obtains today in Honduras, how sometimes a conflict which grabs the attention of people around the world, first page news or first item on the news, allows you to play what I call trivial pursuit and identify capitals of heretofore unknown countries. What's the capital of Honduras? I wonder how many people in the room today could
have pronounced it.
It's not an easy one. But what if the situation in Honduras, which is it's very close to home, of course, and you know, it involves Chavez and it involves Obama and it involves the OAS and it involves a lot of people and institutions that are not too far removed geographically from Canada. Of course, as you know, Canada has been a member of the OAS for about, 20 years now, I guess.
It's anniversary.
Yeah. What role can I have a double-barrel question. What role can Canada, Canadians play vis-à-vis the situation in Honduras? And my second question is, what if the results of the election go the other way?
What do you mean the other way?
Well, what if it's not what is expected?
Yeah. Okay. Those are good questions. The first question actually is very pertinent because I believe he's still there, but Minister Kent is actually in Honduras with other foreign ministers trying to negotiate something. We're not sure where it's going to go.
Is that under the aegis of the Arias mediation?
It's connected with that.
It's connected with that.
Mm-hmm. And the OAS is there as well, and some Latin American foreign ministers are there. And you know, Canada has a very important role to play. One of the conditions, as I understand it, for Canada's entrance into the OAS was that there would be the democracy issue. And so Canada brought it to the table. Canada has always played an active role. And I think that Canada is in a good place to do that because Canada is not the United States, Canada is not Britain. So that gives it a credibility and even respectability that can help open doors, and its good offices are really good in a lot of cases. Honduras is much more complicated than it should be, so we don't know where it's going to go. What happens if the elections don't go as anticipated? Well, this is what's so, to be honest, bizarre about Honduras. The unity of the elite, the political elite, the economic elite, in supporting the coup was unprecedented. And it's impressive because the stakes were actually pretty low. So the immediate catalyst, Zedela wanted to have a non-binding plebiscite to see if people would support his running for a second term. And it was unconstitutional. But it was also non-binding. The irony is that at the time, he only had about 30% support. And given people's obvious opposition to him running again, it's clear that the opposition would have voted. The supporters, which were a minority, and poor people generally, tend not to vote. So it's hard to imagine that he would even have won the non-binding referendum. The other irony is that in November, elections were to be held to find his replacement in January, and those seem to be on track. And his own party supported the coup. And so I'm saying that because it's hard to imagine why it won't go the way that the government expects, because everybody is agreed at the political level. And some polls say now a majority of people are in support of Zelaya because he's the victim. Other polls say it's even gone down a bit. So we don't really know how many people support the president. But it's pretty clear that the outcome come November will probably be the same that it would have been without the coup. You know, so all these things are always gratuitous anyway, but this is really, really gratuitous because the opposition to the man was so unified.
Yeah.
And one last thing, too. This links into some of the things that Khalid was saying. What really started this? The president was a rancher, a businessman, center-right, conservative, And when prices of oil shot through the roof, Honduras, a very, very poor country, couldn't import the oil that it needed to keep the economy going. And so we went to Chavez, who has plenty of oil and is more than happy to help. But Chavez said, I will help you only if, and the conditions were that he would sign on to this Bolivarian project. Now, eventually, it seems that Zelaya became convinced that this was the way to go. We don't really know. But the point is that it all started with economic vulnerability, and that's something that you know, Canada, as a major energy producer, should be able to play at least as an important role as Chavez.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you very much. I'm reminded of an experience which I lived when I was in New York, when you were talking about the American Canadian diplomacy, and we have our own line, and we have our own interests. And I remember this one of those many skeptical Canadian journalists after a vote in the Security Council. This was during the first Gulf War, and we had voted the same way as the United States. And she interviewed me and said, "Well, why does Canada always follow the United States?" And I floored her with my reply. I said, "Has it ever occurred to you that it was a case of the United States following Canada?" And she was absolutely speechless. Anyway, I digress. I think unless our friends have any point that they would like to take with one another, and I will give you 5 seconds to think about it, I'm going to open the meeting for discussion. David, please stand up. Let the world see.
Sure.
And give us your name.
I'm one of the professors in the Thompson Center for Entrepreneurial Studies. I've got a real problem with the democratic ideal if the United Nations still allows the veto on something that the world seems to agree on, North Korea, for instance. How can we move forward if the most democratic institution, theoretically the United Nations, allow one country or another, in that particular case, China, to say, no, we're not going to slap North Korea? So perhaps you can answer that, but I would like one other question at the end of that, which is a totally different subject.
Okay.
Perhaps.
Okay, well, the moderator shouldn't do that, but I'll get the ball rolling. As you know, the right of veto for the five so-called winners of the Second World War was a condition sine qua non of the charter being signed. Of course, it doesn't, in geopolitical terms, it doesn't represent a reality today in 2009. But yes, China and Russia and the United States and France and Great Britain have a right of veto. And it can put a damper on any resolution that comes before it. The Security Council, and North Korea is a case in point, and that is why the discussions are being held outside of the context of the United Nations, you know, with China, the United States, Japan, South Korea, and who am I missing? Russia, of course, yeah. How can you forget Russia? It's so good question. But then, you know, why did the war in ex-Yugoslavia, eventually require the participation of NATO? It was because the Soviets were voting with their and protecting their Slav brethren. And France had, a special interest with Croatia, and you're always looking at the country's immediate interest, which drives its actions and its interests, its activities on the international scene. But enough on the part. Yes,
François. Who said the UN was democratic? It's not democratic. It's not elected. It's not representative of the people, otherwise China would have a quarter of the votes. It's a power structure that was established after a power struggle, and it runs the world in the format that was the format it had in 45, and it'll probably change in the future. There will be some crisis that will create change of that, but it's certainly not democratic.
But it works. It works, and it's amazing that it does. Sometimes it does not. It did not in 2003, of course, most recent situation where the United States went at it alone. But generally it does work, and very often I'm still an aficionado of the UN. I don't think I'm as naive as I used to be, but still an aficionado. Do you want to kick in? Yes, please.
It's not only the Security Council that's non-democratic. The UN General Assembly is very politicized, too, which means that when it works that much better because people say, wow, if they can come up with that level of agreement, it really means something. But it also means we need to look for alternatives in parallel, not to undermine the UN. And I think in that regard, one of the most positive changes in a long time is the transition from the G8 economic group to the G20, because what that does is it opens up things in a way that recognizes the world isn't what it used to be.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
I've got a very basic
question. Your name, please. Yeah. Good architecture.
Now, you sort of state that the big problem is our corporate democracy. The thing that hits me very, very much, nobody has really defined democracy. The definition becomes free elections. Now, we all know the perfect example of what's going on in Afghanistan today, but even in the United States, where I'm living right now, the bill says democracy is functioning in the elections. The elections are so thwarted by the areas of who gets elected by what, because computers, so everybody knows who's a Democrat, who's a Republican, and so the districts are so set that in California, it can never change unless it's a political revolution. So I think the word democracy really needs some kind of definition, and it's a very, very broad definition, because the perfect example is the United States, and I was involved in the early 70s on NGO housing in what was called Habitat.
Vancouver.
Vancouver, right. Mm. And so the big question is, what is democracy? And it's a very, very basic and a very, very difficult question, and of all academia in the world, nobody has really given it a definition or a rule or a set.
Now, there's a challenging question. Who wants to field it? Habib?
Well, I'd be remiss if I did not say, because I worked with the UN and know so many people, that you should also think about the agencies of the United Nations and not the Security Council. That's very important, because everyone accepts that the Security Council is not democratic, but we sometimes really obscure the wonderful work of the UNDP and UNESCO and all of those things that actually bring us together as an international community, and that is something we forget sometimes. I went to a United Nations school growing up, so I have a little trick and treating for UNICEF and all that. that was fun. That was a lot of fun. In terms of that four, I was trying to say that long-term political liberalization is important for sustaining peace. But in terms of resolving conflicts in the short term, it has to do with a particular form of diplomacy that is energized, sustained, and takes account of regional actors, regional groups. So in the case of Darfur, Chad was not brought in, for example, earlier. There was what we call fast-track diplomacy, unwillingness to sustain the talks. And then when the factions split up, and this happens often, the different countries took sides, instead of bringing these factional leaders together. So there are lots of things associated with peace talks and negotiations and conflict resolution that Canada and others can take more seriously by using other examples that are successful. But in the long term, I'm going to allow Professor Oxhorn to define democracy for you. So I'm going to sidestep that. He's my senior colleague, so I can do that.
Okay, Philip.
I, of course, can opinionate. But there's a really important issue, and that is, It's like the U.S. Supreme Court decision. I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. The same with democracy in a better sense. And that's why when I look at it, it's governments that are responsible and accountable. And so elections, by definition, are supposed to do that. Now, the processes that you mentioned, yeah, that distorts it. But not so much so that the outcome doesn't have some resonance in society. But at the same time, because it's so easy to say, well, there were elections, they were free and fair, that's all you need for democracy, it's easy to measure, it's easy to point to, we forget that so much happens in between, and that's really where the responsiveness and the accountability is. Kind of like the UN agencies that are clearly more responsive, if not more accountable sometimes, than the new UN Security Council. And when I teach this, one of my favorite ploys is to use examples where democracy proves its strength during its crises. So what would better evidence of the quality of a U.S. democracy than the way it survived Watergate? Because what it meant is that there's accountability. It may not be the kind or as much as we like, but there are recourses. And so in Latin America, where I work the most, I mean, what rings true is you say, what happens when someone screws up? What happens when the elections clearly aren't fair or free? Are there mechanisms to seek recourse? And sadly, but truly, oftentimes they're not. This is where the institutions that Francois mentioned are key. You can't have any kind of democracy without strong, solid institutions. Because otherwise you have corruption, you have clientelism, you have all the things that flourish that prevent responsiveness in a meaningful way and deny accountability. And so for me, that's where you have to focus on. And elections can be a very useful tool, but we can't fool ourselves into thinking that's the be-all and end-all of democracy, which unfortunately sometimes happens.
For my students, from the legal standpoint, I usually define democracy as representation plus human rights plus the rule of law. And representation is your responsible government, responsive government. Human rights is part of the responsive, but also the accountability, and the rule of law is the accountability mechanism. So we're actually saying the same thing in different words.
Interesting. What about Afghanistan in particular that Marvin referred to? I mean, are we over influenced by the many statements that have been made by so many people that, of course, these were not free and fair? You're talking about tens of thousands of wasted ballots, voting stations that did not open on voting day, etc. And Karzai, who is today, says, you know, we won 56% of the votes. I remember we had a cleaning lady many years ago, and she was a wonderful woman, and sometimes she would look at my wife and she would say, what to do? So I'd say, what do we do with Afghanistan? We've got these men and women who are, you know, being killed, the body bags. There are more and more body bags coming back to the United States. The parallel with Vietnam and more recently Iraq is being drawn. Where is Afghanistan going?
Well, I mean, I have some thoughts.
A little ways from South
America. Yeah, but you know, I try and learn more about the world. To solve Afghanistan, I'm not going to pretend to know what to do, because although I have some ideas, but I think what Afghanistan really underscores is two things. One is that it shouldn't have happened. And I'll be honest, I think part of the problem is because elections are so easy to point to as deliverables, right? That time frames for creating elections are too rushed. You know, it doesn't take long to learn how to be a Democrat. We look at Iran, where there's been no history of democracy and people are mobilizing because those numbers weren't counted, and that's not supposed to happen even in Iran. So the problem, though, is to build the institutions that can do the counting, to build the parties, to build the checks and balances, and civil society can play an important role in making sure the votes are counted right. That takes time. And so what we need is a longer-term time frame that's not reduced to sometimes arbitrary electoral cycles in the West, so that you avoid these problems. But once they happen, you know, we can talk about it here, but I guarantee you people in Honduras and Kupwaters all over the world, including Pakistan, are saying, well, look, if Afghanistan gets away with it, are we as important to the U.S. or the U.N. or whoever as Afghanistan? Well, Pakistan probably is more important. Mm-hmm. Honduras isn't, but they're getting away with it anyway, apparently. And so it's really important that if these problems happen, if you can't avoid it for whatever reason, you got to call them as you see them, because you know, we sometimes forget that just because the UN or the OAS or whatever body it is says these elections were unfair, people are going to say, yeah, you're right. You know, there's a lot of skepticism, particularly because, let's face it, the West, the North, however you want to define it, isn't always consistent. So they condemn Honduras, but they kind of turn a blind eye to Afghanistan. And so people, you know, we all live on the same planet. We all watch CNN or whatever. Maybe not Fox, because that's less appealing. You know, so you can't keep these secrets.
Good intervention. Hadi, do you want to say something?
I wanted to say something because I did a lot of research in Somalia, not in Afghanistan. And especially in northern Somalia. And I don't know Afghanistan. I know it's a greater concern here, but I think there's similarities because they're both collapsed states. They're both traditional societies. They're predominantly, almost exclusively Muslim societies. And the difference in Somalia, and also there was intervention in Somalia, of course, by the UN and the US, you know, in a different way, but we have one in Afghanistan. And I have to be honest, I've never been in favor of that intervention in Afghanistan, even though my American friend said, you know, Khalid, you know, Taliban is over there and Al-Qaeda. That's another issue. But in Somalia, which I think is replicable in Afghanistan, in the north they have been able to manage a successful democracy. In the south they have not. There are two factors for them. One of them is that they were left alone in the north, as opposed to the military and UN intervention in the south. So sometimes absence of interventions is actually conducive. But even more important is, and this is not to be idealistic, but the fact is that for these societies, democratization, and this speaks to your question, had to do in Somalia, and I did research in it and spent a year in Hargeisa and in Bosaso, it had to do with sustained negotiations between the different clans and groups. You know, there are always traditional democratic institutions that can be aided, not undercut, but can be aided, and we have to learn from that. That includes recognizing, and I wrote an op-ed for the Global Mail on it, recognizing local legitimate leaders. And that is, and some people I spoke to said, well, you know, that's impossible to find in Afghanistan. Well, in Somalia, spending a year there, it was quite clear who were the legitimate local leaders who had the popularity of the different groups. Once that is established, you can facilitate negotiations across the different groups. Mm. And so eventually, I think in Afghanistan, I'm not sure that any that kind of durable peace would either come with a military victory, which I'm not sure, I don't know about that, or it will come from these kind of cross-tribal and cross-ethnic kind of negotiations on the ground that can be facilitated. And I think that the success of Somaliland, the success even of Puntland, in northeast Somalia, and the lack of success in Mogadishu in the south can give us an idea of the possibilities of conflict resolution in Afghanistan, and also building democracy, as we put it, from scratch, building it from the bottom up. And eventually, I think that is probably a vision that we should start thinking about in Afghanistan.
Chercher le groupe. Chercher le bon groupe. Madame, you had your hand up.
My name is Levon Levy, and my question was you talked about democracy as a tool in your conflict resolution, tool in the toolbox, but when you're working with institutions, and I guess I'll throw it open to the panel, but how do you propose to go about in some of the discussions that have been going on, establishing democratic institutions in areas where you've got institutions that have been going on for centuries, usually based on a religious or cultural beliefs, that I know it's time, but from a Western society point of view, we want to make it happen now. And maybe that's where we're coming into trouble with the intervention. But in a lot of these countries where there are human rights issues, those things have been going on for centuries.
Yeah. Francois?
I'm not sure I'm the right person to
answer. Well,
I can only say that, if I say a few words, is that institutions are not built instantly. Institutions are the results of processes.
negotiation processes. They are the result of traditions. I mean, the kind of parliament we have started probably in the 6th century in Saxony. You know, it's something that comes from a long history. So institutions cannot be created instantly. We have, however, created a few institutions that have, over on this planet, that have proven successful at doing certain kinds of things. You know, the Human Rights Commission model, for example, has been replicated. It's been invented at one point. It's been replicated. There are principles of Paris that say that, you know, list the principles that should apply to human rights commissions. You know, it should be independent. The commissioners should be appointed not by the government. They should not be paid by the government. They should be able to receive individual complaints. They should be able to choose themselves the files they want to work on, etc., etc. So, you know, we have developed that. You cannot take this and transplant it. You can offer it in a negotiation, saying, would the member of the groups like to establish this so that the individual people can access this, and this would deal with such and such type of conflicts inside society. You can do that. You can bring that toolbox to a negotiation, but it has to be appropriated. It has to be appropriated culturally. It has to be appropriated sociologically. It has to become the thing of the people who are negotiating, in order to establish a peaceful society. But I'm going to stop there, and you're going to go into concrete examples.
So collapses are different examples. Although political scientists also, we really would love to give a recipe for democratization, and some have attempted to. And there are different elements that are shared across countries. I think the answer I have to that is when people ask me about the compatibility of Islamic countries and democracy. And first of all, there are many democratizing Islamic countries. But as a colleague of mine has written and writes a lot about, the fact is that people believe in it. They may say that we have our own version of it, or they use different kind of cultural terminologies. But the fact is that the majority of people now have internalized the norm of democracy itself. That is a great starting point for you in terms of saying, and people in Darfur, the reason I mentioned that is when I ask them, you know, what is your solution, they say we want political representation and resource sharing. They don't say we want them to stop the killing right now, believe it or not. Very politically sophisticated people, it has been internalized, they feel it's part and parcel of their resolution and their long-term interest. That's a wonderful starting point to begin. In Africa, democratization, political liberalization has been highly successful, although people don't really look at what happened in the 90s to the present, but many African countries, as opposed to Middle Eastern countries, have liberalized their political system. In the case of Kenya, it's has shown that it's a very important source of conflict resolution also. Those kind of things are important. The electoral institutions and engineering should be taken case by case, and I think that we have many successful examples of that. But I would just conclude by saying it's generally what people want across different cultures. The norm itself has been internalized. Institutional buildup is left to people like Professor Oxhorn and others. Like
you can't resist that.
That's a segue. Right?
I've worked mostly in Latin America, and Latin America has been independent now for 200 years, sometimes a little longer. But democracy has never really taken hold until just recently, and there's some questions about how deep it is. And so people often said, is there Catholic, conservative, traditional culture inherited from the Spanish crown way back when? Until the Catholic Church became a major proponent of democracy in the 1970s. So cultures, on the one hand, can change in dramatic ways, and on the other hand, you know, we don't always understand what we mean by culture, and we need to be careful in how we identify cultures. I mean, so we, you know, Khalid talked about the idea that extremists are a very small minority of Islams. Well, same thing in the U.S. in particular. What would we do if Judeo-Christian culture were defined by the Ku Klux Klan, even though it has deep roots or claims to have deep roots in a Christian kind of fundamentalism? So we need to understand that, you know, what is portrayed as the culture may not really be how people actually think. And I think that Alita's right, that there's now a recognition, and maybe there was before, we'll never know because we didn't do opinion surveys, that people say, we want accountable and representative governments. And that's a real starting place. The other thing is that I think we need to draw the line, and I think that Francois' point is really important. Human rights, they're all over the place in terms of what they may or may not include. I mean, I was talking to somebody from, actually, a predecessor of yours from Canada and the UN. He was saying that they would be afraid to try and get the Declaration of Human Rights passed today.
Oh, yeah.
It wouldn't happen. But I think what is clear, though, is that certain things are just not tolerable. You know, a simple, almost banal way to say it is that if it hurts people physically, then that's probably wrong. And that's where we need to draw the line. But beyond that, that's where democracy negotiation and trying to understand comes into play. It's, you know, having a foot in the ground, or foot on the ground, talking to people, looking for negotiations where we can't have give and take. I'll just give you one quick anecdote. A few years ago, one of my students, she was Muslim, Lebanese. Her parents were living in Cyprus. She was coming to school in Montreal, and she said, "You know, my parents are letting me live here alone in Montreal on one condition, that I wear a headscarf." Am I enslaved? No. In fact, I don't even have to wash my hair if I don't want to. And that was the point. You know, it gave her complete autonomy by doing this small thing. So for her, it was empowering and not an infringement at all. So we need to open up our eyes a little bit and think what it really, really means. Drawing the line firmly when it's just intolerable. And we know what the examples of that are. But beyond that, there's a huge gray area that can only be dealt with an open mind and a north-south exchange in which we have an understanding. And one of our colleagues, Charles Taylor, has written a lot about this. And it's the idea that rather than we learn from other cultures rather than just accept it, we go one step farther. That's very democratic.
Good question and good answers. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. My name's Dan. I'm a student here in history and also a past student in mathematics. This summer, I accompanied 30 CSF students to Peru for a month. And while we were there, we saw a really brilliant example of democracy in action. We saw people of Peru rise up against a government bill that privatized huge amounts of the rainforest in northern Peru. And so while we were in Cusco, we saw old women, old men, young men, the entire array of society, people from way up in the mountains, who spoke very little Spanish, mostly just speaking the Quechua, come down to the traditional capital of the Inca Empire and protest against the government's action and bringing in of corporations into what is part of the patrimoine of the people of Peru. So that's an aspect of democracy that sort of we haven't yet discussed today. I think it's really important that people on the streets can really make a difference.
Thank you for that intervention. Did I see another hand over here? Yes, madam. Well, I don't know who on our panel is going to feel that one, but it certainly did eventually work in South Africa. I mean, that's the case in favor of sanctions, but who would like to
Real quick on Honduras. They worked in South Africa. Other areas, it's more controversial. But my opinion is that the longer you wait, the less likely they are to work, or the more difficult it will be. And so if sanctions were going to work in Honduras, it would have been the day of the coup, when the regime is most vulnerable, when people are trying to figure out, is it going to last? Should I support it? What's really going on? That's when you have to do it, because the longer you wait, the more entrenched the regime becomes.
Would they work in Iran? As you know, they're different types of sanctions that are being considered by the Group of Six. But is it conceivable that, leaving aside whether China and or Russia would join in the imposition of bank sanctions, for example, would they work on a country like Iran?
Well, I think Iran is like Sudan, which I'm much more familiar with, which also has sanctions against it. And, you know, I have to say that initially in the 90s, when I worked at the Brookings Institution, I thought that they would work, frankly. And in retrospect, I think Professor Oxhorn is right. First of all, it's almost impossible for these countries, for there to be a sanctioned regime that doesn't have loopholes. And, of course, whether it is Sudan or Iran, China, and in the case of Iran, Russia, will not follow suit. And if they do, others won't. Certainly in China came in as Europeans and Americans imposed sanctions. And what that allowed the regime to do is actually consolidate its rule even more. In fact, they were able to use the rhetoric of being under siege by, you know, Western forces and talk about neocolonialism. And at the same time, what they did in turn is did not, they kind of implemented their own sanctions against their own civil society. So this is what happens in Iran and Sudan, in the sense that you impose sanctions on these countries and they say, okay, well, you know, we're going to use the rhetoric of neocolonialism and Western intervention, and we're not going to also allow you to help our civil society organizations. So they consolidate their regime even more, and you see it, of course, in the Iranian elections as well. As Iranian friends of mine all sometimes tell me, please tell people not to talk about it ever at all. Don't pay us any attention. It's a way of saying, you know, these governments are very, very opportunistic, and they utilize that a lot. And I'm not sure if that is an argument against sanctions. But certainly, if I was to be asked, would sanctions be more important or helping civil society organizations? You know, if there was a kind of a choice between those, I would really focus on the latter.
There were also reports, for example, the long sanction regime of Iraq, mm-hmm. after between the first and the second Gulf War. There were reports in the UN that first it had consolidated power of Saddam Hussein himself and his regime and the authoritarian elite, and second, it was probably the most important cause for important violations of economic and social rights of the people. They didn't have enough food. They couldn't go to school. They didn't have access to power supply. The interplay between the authoritarian rule and the sanctions created huge problems for the population.
Yeah. And Hussein and his clique did not go hungry. when we talk about sanctions and the situation in South Africa, you know, one of the mantras of our discussion today is, can Canada make a difference? This is a case where, and I was involved tangentially, and Canada did make a difference in the Commonwealth. Madame Thatcher, there was no way that Madame Thatcher was going to be an advocate of harsh sanctions against South Africa. And Canada, under the leadership of the then Prime Minister, Mulroney, you know, took the lead. And he led the pack, the frontline states, and he was instrumental in the sanctions, you know, being kept in place and indeed being increased. As I say, the rest is very much history. We have time for one last question. David, I know you warned us that you had a second question, but I'll make a deal with you. One question here, and then you get the closing.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
I have some questions about economic sanctions in Zimbabwe. Why have they not worked?
Well, I think there's a very short answer, in my view, if I may preempt my colleagues, but principally because the OAU has not supported them. In particular, the then president of South Africa, you know, did not lead the movement in favor of sanctions. So Mugabe could do as he pleased, and he did, and it's a horror story. One question over here. Your name? Yeah.
And so democracy and democratic governance and so on is
discussion. But what happens when a country or a people elect democratically elect a government and the world doesn't like that government? I mean, one of the example that comes to mind is Hamas, obviously, for obvious reasons. And the other concern was in Egypt, if they allow elections and the Islamic Brotherhood came out or other such parties. What do you do then? Do you say, oh, democracy is okay, but not for you, or not for this party, or not for this ideology, or...
Algeria, I'm on D3. There are, unfortunately, many cases that can be referred to. I'll let our friends.
That's a really delicate issue, obviously, because it's politicized in a lot of different ways. But it's a good question, and I think that what I'll just a former teacher of mine, Samuel Huntington, who was very much in favor of democratic promotion, but also very much he wrote a very famous book on the importance sometimes of the iron fist of authoritarianism. And what he said in Algeria was that it was too soon, because we didn't know what the Islamic Party would have done had they taken office, and there were indications that power would moderate them. So I think that the lesson there is that if it's democratically and freely elected, the only criteria we can apply is the same criteria, whether or not those countries respect minimal democratic ideals in their relations with other countries and within their relationship with their own society. I mean, I think that if we want to be consistent, we can't say societies can elect democratic leaders to destroy democracy. That's the question mark. But obviously, there's no, beyond that you know, platitude, there's not really much you can do except for case-by-case things.
I also think that, you know, there's not, I think there's a misunderstanding looking at Hamas or looking at Egypt, you know, or Algeria. I mean, people are voting, it seems like the most important opposition, you know, and that seems to kind of bring up all these security fears. But the fact of the matter is the majority of many people who vote for those organizations are not necessarily long-time supporters. And they, you know, we don't look beyond kind of, you know, let's say the Islamic label, so to speak, and understand whether it was Algeria, it was clear there were Berbers, there were non-Islamists who were voting in the in that country's first round of elections, especially the local parliament, local elections. The same thing with Hamas, it's not clear if they're all really Hamas supporters or others voting for Hamas for different reasons. Those questions are crucial and important, and it can allay the fears of even those in the West and others who are concerned about that. All they have to do is try to secure institutionally a second round of elections. So for example, in Egypt, you can actually, you know, say to the Muslim Brotherhood, A, we'll legalize your party with particular restrictions, you know, including your kind of agreement that other secular parties are allowed. And that can be enshrined and institutionalized and monitored and all of that kind of stuff. And in the Egypt case, I just returned from there, you will see something very interesting happening. It's a very large Islamic movement, but at the same time, there is a new generation that is coming to the fore that is talking very specifically about the importance of secular parties, women's rights, the importance of a Christian being allowed to be leader if he's elected. Those things are very much part of the deepening of democratization in civil society. So maybe we should look at these organizations as we look at other similar associations and organizations as well, I think.
What if Mubarak succeeds in having his son succeed him? But that's for another day. Okay, David, I give you the last question.
Democracy, obviously, is people imposing a system on the earth that has its own agenda. And when you have democracy in a country that is confronting a regional, multi-country problem, how can we reconcile the realities of the great thirst that is coming? Where Egypt has said it will go to war if any of the other nations on the Nile touch any of the water. If you go to the sub-root of most of the conflicts, it's access to rubber and pasturage. And how does democracy face the regional realities that are caused by the earth, not by man?
Okay. Who's going to who's going to drink to the last drop?
I'll give you a really
simple answer. I'd rather a democratic government tried to do it than a non-democratic government. Because it's,
yeah. Thanks for saving us.
Yeah. Well, I think we've come to the end of what has been a fabulous discussion. I'd like to thank our three participants very sincerely. It's been. Is this all for me? It's been a great pleasure and a very rewarding task for me to moderate this discussion, and we cannot leave without presenting a token of McGill's appreciation to each one of you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. Now you see how McGill's efforts are paying off when you hear three outstanding McGill researchers, professors, who have made a difference, not just at McGill, but on the planet. And they're here with many other McGill professors, many other McGill researchers, and this is why McGill is such an outstanding university, with Nobel Prizes and scholarships and what have you. So, you all support Campaign McGill, and it's one of its principal objectives is to ensure that today's panelists and all of the university staff and students have the tools that they need to succeed. So, thank you very much for your participation.